For antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. Morning, folks. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Brand new Beastie Boys in the background there. I haven't heard it yet, so I'm just going to let it roll. If that's okay with you. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin. You can stream us live worldwide on the internet. KAOS 959.com, and you can find the archives of all the great interviews from this show at antiwar.com. And I start today's show from the pages of antiwar.com with an article by the great investigative reporter Jim Loeb. Neocons try to rally bully Republicans. In the face of a critical Senate debate on future U.S. strategy in Iraq, neoconservatives and other hawks are trying to rally increasingly skeptical and worried Republicans behind continued support for President George W. Bush's five-month-old surge strategy. They are arguing that the surge, the deployment of an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to pacify Baghdad to encourage political compromise among the major groups in Iraq, has not been given sufficient time to work, and that abandoning it now would amount to snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. But the recent defection of several hitherto loyal, if privately critical, senior Republican senators has thrown the hawks both inside and outside the administration into something of a panic, if only because anti-war Democrats appear to be inching steadily toward the kind of majority that Bush can no longer simply ignore. Indeed, the New York Times Monday reported that the administration itself is increasingly divided over what to do, with some officials, notably Defense Secretary Robert Gates, quietly pressing, in quotes from the Times, for beginning a gradual withdrawal of combat troops consistent with the recommendations last December of the Iraq Study Group, of which he was a member until his nomination last November. While the White House, through the personal diplomacy of Bush's National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, has been spending an extraordinary amount of time, quote-unquote, listening to the skeptics in hopes of keeping them from crossing the aisle on key war-related measures due to be voted over the next 2 weeks, neoconservatives allied outside the administration are taking a harsher tack. They are pre-9/11 Republicans, wrote William Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, about Senators Richard Lugar, George Voinovich, Pete Domenici, and John Warner, the four most senior Republicans who have called for a change of course in Iraq over the past week. They have been followers of conventional opinion during their 20-plus Senate careers, not leaders, Kristol went on. Now they are following conventional wisdom again in their stately way in turning against the Iraq War. Republicans may think they can distance themselves from all this, but they'll get no credit from voters if they contribute to an ugly outcome in Iraq, argued the lead editorial in Monday's Wall Street Journal. a divided Republican caucus that undercuts America's military efforts while chasing the mirage of bipartisan comedy will only make their own election defeat in November 2008 more likely. Both warnings came as the Senate begins what is expected to be a debate that could stretch until Congress's August recess on the nearly $650 billion 2008 defense authorization bill, to which Democrats hope to attach a series of Iraq-related amendments that are fiercely opposed by the hawks. At least two Democratic amendments, both backed by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, will call for withdrawing all U.S. combat forces from Iraq by sometime next spring or summer. They also... By sometime next spring or summer? God. Fucking... Oh, these Democrats, they just kill me, man. I'd rather read about William Crystal than about these Democrats. You know? It's like, here I am, I'm in a good mood. I got Beastie Boys playing. Gonna be talking with my buddy Vineyard Saker here in a few minutes. And I gotta read about Harry Reid. I need to train myself to where when my peripheral vision finds the shapes representing the words Harry Reid on a page, that I just skip that paragraph, that somehow it just becomes automatic and I don't put myself through this. Yeah, Harry Reid will call for withdrawing all U.S. combat forces from Iraq by sometime a year from now or so. Thanks a lot, Democrats. Good for nothing. U.S. combat forces from Iraq by sometime next spring or summer. They will also more narrowly define the mission of the remaining troops, still likely to number in the tens of thousands. As training Iraqi forces, that's a euphemism for the Iran party's religious militias, helping to secure international borders, striking Al-Qaeda and other terrorist targets, who of course are only there because we're there, and can only be there as long as we're there, and protecting U.S. facilities and personnel there. Yes, these are the loopholes in the Democrats' timeline proposal that you could drive an entire war through. I'm sorry, I thought that's what we're doing in Iraq right now. Training Iraqi forces, helping to secure international borders, striking at terrorist targets, and force protection of our guys that are there doing the things listed above. Isn't that the excuse for keeping us in Iraq right now? Isn't that what they're telling us right now? That's why we're there? We gotta train up the Iraqi troops and fight Al-Qaeda? And on like that? These are the Democrats' loopholes. This is how the Democrats tell the Republicans, look, you have to stop the war, except for the war. You can keep that going. But other than that, you have to stop it, though. That's like George Bush saying, don't torture unless it's within military necessity. Then go ahead. Is there a more sickening bunch of cowards in this country than the Senate Democrats? Is there a human form between Canada and Mexico who represents a weaker symbol of manhood than Harry Reid? Harry Reid is the majority leader of the Senate. The leader of the opposition in the Senate. And what does he have to say about any of this?
Well, gee, guys, I don't know. Being sensitive is no laughing matter, and I think that we're going to have to try real hard to, train up the Iraqi army and fight Al-Qaeda and, you know, maybe try, hopefully, to start beginning to end the war after another year from now.
Is there a more pathetic man occupying the land between Canada and Mexico anywhere than Harry Reid, the majority leader of America's Imperial Senate? Is there any greater coward in this country than Harry Reid. I can't think of one. Here we have the neocons who got nothing. I mean, look at this William Crystal up here saying, you know, Republicans, if you go along with this, then you're going to get blamed too if you contribute to an ugly outcome in Iraq. William Crystal writes in July of 2007. Yeah, if there's some sort of ugliness in Iraq, you Republicans might get the blame from it if you stop the war now. These are the arguments that Harry Reid is up against. That's the best the war party can come up with. Everything's going swimmingly, but you, cowardly Senate Republicans are trying to snatch victory in Iraq from the jaws of defeat. And the leader of the Democrats doesn't have the balls to stand up and say, hogwash. It's your war, Mr. Crystal, and you lost it, pal. How do you like that? Well, you know, I'm Harry Reid, guys, and I've been thinking that, you know, maybe if we're real nice and ask the Republicans really nicely, if maybe we could put up a timetable bill that has us getting our troops out by maybe somewhere around a year from now with 10 major exceptions. What do you think, guys? I'm Harry Reid, and I'm running for U.S. Senate. Please vote Reid. Please. How did this guy become the majority leader of the Senate? How could it be that that's the leader of the opposition of the lawmakers in the United States of America, Harry Reid? The most pathetic coward in our entire land somehow is the majority leader of the Senate. I mean, I can understand the most pathetic coward in our land being a senator. Makes sense. If you ask me, hey, if you had to pick the most pathetic coward in the land, do you think it might be someone in the U.S. Senate? I would say, yeah, there's a good likelihood it's somebody in the U.S. Senate. But does it have to be the majority leader of the Senate? And I'm sorry, because that's not even what this article is about, but I got off on this tangent about this ballless little wimp, Harry Reid, the most pathetic coward in all of North America, and maybe the entire Western Hemisphere. It's true that if you spent about 15 minutes, you could find four-year-olds with more courage than Harry Reid. You could find kitty cats with more courage than Harry Reid. If you spent, you know, 5 minutes or so looking for one. Ooh, sorry, I kind of got a chip on my shoulder about these damn Democrats. They're driving me crazy, man. Driving me crazy, these Democrats. Oh, yeah. Well, we're calling for a pullout around a year from now or so with the exception of training the army and fighting Al-Qaeda and having enough soldiers to protect the soldiers that we have there training the army and fighting Al-Qaeda. I mean, it's just criminal, isn't it? Isn't it just criminal for the Democrats to be going along with this? For perpetuating this catastrophe, this human catastrophe. I mean, is Harry Reid any less of a war criminal now than the Republicans? This pathetic coward, Harry Reid. Anyway, I'm sorry. Continuing with the Jim Loeb article here from antiwar.com today. Another likely amendment co-sponsored by Senators Hillary Clinton and Robert Byrd would repeal Congress's 2002 authorization for the use of force in Iraq and require Bush to seek a new authorization defining the specific mission and strategy of U.S. forces there before additional money could be spent on the war. which is ridiculous. And of course, Hillary can't wait to vote for it, the new authorization. And she won't regret that one either, and she won't say sorry for that one either. Yet another, sponsored by Senator James Webb, would require that active duty troops be given at least the same amount of time to rest at home as they are deployed in a war zone. How very thoughtful. A provision that would make continuation of the current surge of a total of 165,000 Army troops and Marines in Iraq impossible to sustain. While the White House believes it can keep enough Republicans in line on these amendments to defeat their adoption, it is worried that one or two of them could attract as many as 60 votes, and thus highlight the erosion in support for its strategy over the past month. A strong anti-war showing would increase pressure to reverse course even before the mid-September report. General David Petraeus, the military commander charged with implementing the surge, is expected to submit to Congress. Until last week's defections, the surge would not come under serious challenge until after Petraeus delivered his assessment. The hawks, however, are also very concerned that another amendment, the product of several weeks' work by as many as a dozen centrist Democrats and Republicans, including several of the Republican defectors, may be approved by a veto-proof margin. That amendment would declare the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group, which was co-chaired by former Secretary of State James Baker III and former Democratic Representative Lee Hamilton, to be official U.S. policy. Those recommendations, which included a withdrawal of U.S. combat forces by the end of next March, U.S. diplomatic engagement with Syria and Iran, and intensified efforts to achieve a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, are considered anathema by the hawks, especially pro-Likud neoconservatives, who launched a major propaganda campaign against the Iraq Study Group even before it released its study 7 months ago. Lugar, the ranking Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, explicitly endorsed key ISG recommendations in a major policy address 2 weeks ago, in which he warned that failure to initiate a drawdown of U.S. combat forces in Iraq very soon could pose, quote, extreme risks for U.S. national security because it would greatly increase the chances for a poorly planned withdrawal from Iraq or possibly the broader Middle East region that could damage U.S. interests for decades. Lugar's remarks were hailed at the time by John Warner, who predicted that a number of other Republicans were likely to voice similar concerns in the upcoming debate over the defense bill. Warner, whose former chairmanship of the Armed Services Committee has made him particularly influential on defense issues with his fellow Republicans, has since become the subject of intense White House lobbying. After his speech, Lugar became a focus of neoconservative wrath, with Crystal describing his address as a case study in pseudo-thoughtfulness, full of cheek-puffing and chin-pulling. Oh, God. There's some kind of irony thing, switch in your brain that gets turned off when you leave the communist movement and join the conservative movement, apparently. No sense of irony whatsoever from these former communist, pro-Israel, Likudnik, crazy traitors to America that call themselves the neocons. Pardon me, that was my little parentheses there, not Jim Loeb's writing. Back to Jim Loeb here, and Thomas Donnelly of the American Enterprise Institute accusing Warner of sounding more like an investor rebalancing his portfolio, selling Iraq and buying Israel-Palestine, than a man thinking about strategy and war. In their view, the neocons' view, the surge has resulted in major military gains in recent weeks, even if the political reconciliation that it was supposed to promote has been nowhere in sight, a point made emphatically by Lugar, Warner, and other Republican critics. The tragedy of these efforts is that we are on a cusp of potentially being successful in the next year in a way that we have failed in the 3+ preceding years, retired General Jack Keane, one of the surge's architects, who made much the same point at a special AEI forum on the surge here Monday, that's the American Enterprise Institute, told the neoconservative New York Sun last week. But because of this political pressure, it looks like we intend to pull out the rug from underneath that potential success. In its own editorial Monday, the New York Sun called the possibility, called the possible approval of legislation setting a withdrawal timetable the most astounding act of perfidy in the history of Congress. Jesus. All right. For those who don't know, let me tell you. You've heard the word neocon. The neocons, the neocons, the neocons. What does that mean? Well, it means new conservatives. But what it doesn't mean is, people who are conservatives nowadays. What it means, it's a biographical definition. It means someone who used to be a communist, and now they're fascist. Military-industrial complex tied, Israel lobby tied, warmongers who never, ever, ever stop mongering war. They are not conservatives. They never have been conservatives. I'm not saying conservatives is a good thing. I'm just telling you it's what they're not. They are radicals. They're communists who became conservatives, quote-unquote, when the left-wingers became hippies and anti-war in the late 60s and early 70s. They said, well, let's go take over the Republican Party and make them the party of world revolution then. And they put Israel first, and they don't care how many Americans die, as long as Israel is protected. And the fact that their strategy for protecting Israel does nothing but cause trouble for Israel and for America and for the long-term future of these guys, of American policy, of the American empire that they love so much, is completely, I guess, just blind to them. They're just blind to these facts. They cannot understand this. They refuse to understand this. That their policy just makes everything worse for Israel, as they put Israel first and America last. And you hear that? If Congress, at the behest of 77% of the American people, issues so much as a pathetically weak timeline with giant loopholes you could drive a war through, that, according to the New York Sun, would be the most dangerous act of perfidy in the history of the American Congress. For them to do what 77% of the American people demand. It's insanity. And in fact, I want to play you this clip of Michael Ledeen. He is actually not an ex-communist. My best recollection, he's been a lifelong fascist. But he's very, very close to all the rest of these neoconservatives, who are all former left-wing radicals turned right-wing warmongers. And this is just a very short clip of Ledeen explaining that he doesn't know why people call him a conservative. You know, the question was, why do people call you conservative? And his answer is, beats me.
Right. Why are people who advocate revolution called conservative? Right. I don't know. Beats me.
Okay, see, so that's Michael Ledeen explaining. There's nothing conservative about them except that they joined the Republican Party. They are first and foremost traitors who put a foreign nation's interest before the interests of the United States, Israel. And secondly, they are the intellectual gray matter on the top of the military-industrial complex body, working to obtain more and more welfare for more and more billionaires in this country. And if you're a Republican and you have supported any of the government's foreign policies since September 12th, 2001, you need to understand that you've been had by a bunch of commies, you stupid idiot. Look at you embracing Wilsonian world revolution, embracing Trotsky's doctrine of keep killing everybody till they're all free. Embracing the doctrine that whatever Benjamin Netanyahu wants is what's good for the people of Texas, for example. It's not just that you've been mistaken or had a bad judgment, you were wrong a little bit. You were the dupe of a bunch of communists who joined the Republican Party. That's who they are. And that's who writes in the Weekly Standard, and that's who writes in the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and that's who writes in the New York Sun, that's who writes in the National Review. A bunch of guys who used to be Reds before they became, very conservative, ass-kick first kind of Republican tough guys. And the fact that you can look at Bill Kristol and say to yourself, wait a minute, that guy's not a tough guy. Bill Kristol looks like the biggest pussy this side of Harry Reid. I know little kids that I bet could kick Bill Kristol's ass. The guy's never even grown a whisker on his chin in his whole life. He sure doesn't look like any truck-driving Midwestern tough guy Republican conservative that I've ever seen. He certainly ain't from Texas, interesting little trivia, his father was buddies with Leon Trotsky, the founder of the Soviet Red Army. No, but he's a conservative Republican. And how dare you, slimy, scumbag, wimpy Republican politicians in the Senate, how dare you snatch victory, snatch defeat from the jaws of victory in Iraq? How shameful of you Republicans for even entertaining the idea that it would be a good thing to do as your constituents demand by a majority, a supermajority of 77%. That would be the most disgraceful act of perfidy in the history of the Congress, according to the New York Sun. That would be snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, according to Bill Kristol and the radicals at the Weekly Standard. Make me sick. And if you want to know about that, instead of just hearing about it and thinking I may or may not be right, why don't you just put in your search engine, Trotsky, neocons. I'm sure you'll have no problem learning all about Max Schachtman and the Social Democrats USA Trotskyite sect and all the rest of it. Justin Raimondo's written about it 100 times at antiwar.com. Google it. Neocons, Trotsky. If necessary, neocons, Trotsky, Justin. There'll be 4 or 5 good articles there for you to read. Okay, now, I'm sorry about that. It's time to move on to our guest today. I hope, is that Vineyard Saker on the line? Is that you, bud?
Yes, it is. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great. Hey, everybody, Vineyard Saker, he's some kind of former military guy from some sort of European country. I'm not exactly sure. And now he's a co-blogger of mine at My Stress Blog, and always writes very interesting things, has a very well-informed from formerly inside the government perspective, it seems like to me. And Vineyard Saker, you have this new article up here on Axis of Logic website. That's axisoflogic.com. Iran's asymmetrical response options. This is basically outlining possible consequences and reverberations and so forth if the Cheney administration were to initiate an aggressive war against Iran. Is that right?
Yep.
And now, I guess let's start with the supposed threat to Israel. I know that you know, as well as I know, as well as our audience ought to know, that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad never threatened to wipe Israel off the map because there's no such idiom in Persian, in Farsi, the Persian language. And actually what he said was something along the lines of, boy, I sure wish that the regime in Israel would vanish from the page of time at some point.
Well, actually, I believe he was quoting Ayatollah Khomeini. It wasn't even his own words. He was just repeating, I think, a quote from Khomeini.
Mm-hmm. And now, so we know that that's false. Steady drumbeat of assertions that the leaders of Iran have vowed to kill every Jew in Israel, etc. But
okay,
you
well,
start your article today with, well, go ahead. You
hold on
that?
For 1 sec. The other thing that needs to be pointed out is that Ahmadinejad is not the leader of Iran. He's just the president, which in Iran is something similar to the British Queen. He's more a figurehead. The real leader of Iran is Ali Khamenei, who never said any of that nonsense, or who, as a matter of fact, never says any of the nonsense that Ahmadinejad likes to say. Even if tomorrow Ahmadinejad wanted to start a war, it's nothing you can do about it. The armed forces are directly subordinated to Khamenei. All the centers of power are directly under him. Ahmadinejad is a complete figurehead, so it doesn't really matter what he has to say.
Yeah, well, I think that's just too much detail there, because you know, if TV says that he made some threat, then I guess I'm supposed to take it seriously. Along the same lines, I guess, if a 3 or 4 year old threatened that he was going to beat me up, if TV says, then it should be a real concern, right?
Well, what really happened was Ahmadinejad is not all that popular in Iran. He was elected on an anti-corruption kind of ticket, and he didn't deliver much. So he makes those statements to, you know, cater to a specific audience in Tehran and outside the main city. But he has absolutely no weight at all in terms of Iranian foreign policy, none.
Okay, now listen, for the sake of most of the rest of this interview, you know, if necessary, you know, definitely bring it up. But I want to basically accept the war party's premise, if I can, for this interview, that Iran does mean major harm. Because I'm interested in what harm they're actually capable of carrying out, if we assume their very worst motive. Can Iran wipe Israel off the map?
No, of course not. Not even close. The best they could do is lob a certain amount of missiles armed with conventional warheads at Israel. I mean, that's true. It would serve absolutely no purpose for them, and it would trigger a huge retaliation. Not only on Israel's part, but on the U.S. part. I mean, they know that very well. I mean, the dumbest thing they could do is initiate any kind of action against Israel.
And now, also, when you say a certain number of missiles, give me a ballpark estimate, something.
I would be surprised if they got more than 20 in there, and it wouldn't make much of a difference. I mean, they have long-range missiles, but the longer you lob them, the less accuracy they have. So they have really good missiles for other use. I mean, these missiles were never designed really to deliver anything on Israel. The real targets are much closer to home. And in the future, you know, if one day Iran acquired nuclear weapons, which I don't believe they are trying to or ever will, because again, coming back to Khamenei, there was a fatwa, a religious ruling saying that nuclear weapons are immoral and banned. If they did, they could theoretically place a nuclear warhead, but that would take them years to develop it, so at the same stage as any other country, and shoot it at Israel. I mean, that's what the Israeli politicians are telling their people. The risk, what they're describing, is, you know, using a long-range Iranian missiles to nuke Tel Aviv. That's not even close to being possible right now, at least. I don't think it's possible for the next 10 or 15 years, and even if they had them, they wouldn't do it. Not least because Israel could retaliate in a truly formidable counterstrike. And the Iranians have never attacked anybody. They've never declared that they want to attack anybody. So it's completely hypothetical. It's like saying, you know, would France invade Germany? And, well, possibly. You know, maybe, you know, Mexico tomorrow will try to invade Brazil. But, I mean, it's completely hypothetical. It's silly.
Yeah, well, I am well aware that Iran is nowhere near the capability to produce nuclear weapons, even if they were trying to. Really, I guess the only way they could is if they were to buy some already fissionable material, high-grade material on the nuclear black market. And we know that Valerie Plame and Brewster Jennings and Associates won't be able to stop them since Dick Cheney put them out of business. So, you know, if they were to be able to buy some nuclear black market stuff to make a bomb, it would be Dick Cheney's fault anyway. But
yeah, but even beyond that, I mean, Iranians are extremely sophisticated people, contrary to what is said in a lot of the neocon press. They're very rational, extremely educated, and they have a formidable analytical capability. They know very well that just launching a nuclear weapon serves absolutely no purpose. There are two kind of people out there. Those who think that nuclear weapons can never be used in any kind of logical way, and they have a very good point. But even those who are proponents of nuclear weapons want them to be part of some kind of war-fighting strategy. This is why, for instance, during the Cold War, U.S. and Soviet Union moved away from mutual assured destruction to flexible response. That if you want to start, you know, achieving some kind of goal with a nuclear weapon, you have to have a war-fighting strategy around it. And Iran has nothing near what it would take to do that. Even Israel doesn't have much of a war-fighting strategy with that. That's the last resort safety weapon that they have. There are very few countries out there. I don't think even China has a nuclear war fighting strategy. Mm-hmm. Russia, yes. The U.S., yes. To a certain degree, Britain and France. That's about it. And the Iranians, they understand that very well. If they ever tried to develop a nuclear warfare capability, it would be as a, you know, as a North Korean or Chinese style ultimate protection against attack, not to hit Israel at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, the war party says, and there's got to be something to this. I know that there's something to this. When the war party says that, look, Iran is not run by a bunch of rational men. Iran is run by a theocracy, a bunch of people who are the Persian equivalent of the John Hagee Church down in San Antonio. And that if they have their way, they don't care if Tehran gets nuked, if it's all part of Allah's plan.
No, I don't believe that at all. First of all, I think you can make a better case that the U.S. is run by an insane theocracy, looking at Bush and his prayer meetings at the White House. But if you look really at what the Shia leadership in Iran and the writings of Ali Khamenei and others, they're not even close to being, you know, insane theocrats, foam at their mouth, the raving mullahs who don't care. I mean, that you're describing the Taliban, which were, you know, mortal enemies of Iran. Iran almost went to war against Afghanistan over the Talibans, which they consider completely, you know, barbarians. That's not at all an accurate description of Iran. I would say that their leadership is very, very rational, extremely well-informed. And I would recommend anybody who has any doubt about that to start reading the English-language Iranian press online. And you'll see that this is a complete caricature of what really Iran is all about.
Yeah. You know, it's really unfortunate. I forget the name of the guy. It's so hard to pronounce. It's hard for me to memorize. But we've run a couple of articles on antiwar.com by this guy. The original one was the rumor of the century.
Yeah, yeah.
About Ahmadinejad's quote and the so-called wipe Israel off the map quote. And according to this guy, he says it was the Iranian press agency that actually got the translation wrong in the first place and haven't been able to backtrack from it successfully. And, of course, the Western media would rather take the inflammatory mistranslation made by an Iranian than actually translate it, you know, have someone who speaks English as their first language translate it from Farsi for them.
Yeah. Let me give you an example. I'll give you kind of a proof that Iran is ruled by extremely sophisticated and very rational rulers.
All right.
Ever since the Iranian Revolution, the U.S. has been out there to get them. The Iranians never gave them a reason to actually hit them. They managed to survive in a region that's extremely hostile to them without, I mean, the war against Iran-Iraq war was imposed on them. They never attacked, and they never acted in an insane way, even right after the revolution. There was this case of the taking over of the American embassy, correct. Iran probably had certain links with the people who blew up the U.S. Marine compound and the French in Beirut, although it wasn't Hezbollah. It was probably the, what were they called, the Islamic Jihad. And Iran did kill a number of people abroad. So right after they came to power, there were a number of actions which we could describe as terrorist actions on their part, no doubt. But for a long while now, Iran has been behaving in an extremely responsible way. And if they were, you know, mullah type of, you know, raving at their mouth kind of people, they would have done many other things that would have given the U.S. or anybody else around, you know, a valid reason to actually hit them. They never did. That's hard to do.
Yeah, well, I actually heard Noam Chomsky say when he was asked whether there was ever a circumstance where a country would be justified in waging a preemptive war, and his answer was no, period. But if there was one who had, if there was a state in the world that had the best case for waging a preemptive war, it would be Iran against Israel and the United States. We have openly threatened them with nuclear annihilation repeatedly.
Yeah. Not only that, but, you know, compare Iran to, say, Pakistan, which is truly an insane state. With the dictator who's barely holding on to power, just was, you know, again, there was an attempt to kill him last week, I think.
Yeah.
And these guys have nuclear weapons. They actually have a system that can actually deliver them, which the Iranians have not developed yet. And that's, you know, all the nightmare is sitting there. I mean, the Taliban are essentially there. Their intelligence service are pro-Taliban. They were behind all that. That's a real threat to the region. And God knows what they could do.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to worry about Pakistan.
Well, now, wait a minute. Are the mullahs in Iran really any less crazy than the Taliban, or they're just a different sect of Islam?
I really believe that they're fundamentally totally different.
Okay.
They are really, by their education, if you look at their degree of education, who educated them, where they came from, these people, not all of them, but clearly the Iranian leadership at the top are very educated people, highly sophisticated, very well read. This is not, you know, easy, nurtured, madrasa-produced nutcases from Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
They also have very different religious views. On one hand, you have, you know, Wahhabi, Salafi nutcases, really. On the other hand, you have Shias, who are very, very different in their outlook on things. I do really think that they're different, yeah.
All right, now let's talk about some of the possible consequences. I have to tell you, just, you know, my gut feeling now, I'm much less worried about a war against Iran. Now, clearly, we have guys in Iraq, and we're one border incident away, as Justin Raimondo likes to say at antiwar.com, from a war with Iran. It's definitely not clear that it will not happen no matter what, but it certainly looks less and less likely as Bush's political support in this country just absolutely crumbles. It ought to be extremely difficult for a president at 25-26% approval to start another war.
I disagree with that completely. He can have popularity at 3% as long as the corporate media and Congress are totally, totally committed to neocon values. It doesn't matter. He can start it. He doesn't need, you know, a popular agreement with that. Moreover, he has nothing to lose.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I wrote an article back in 2005 where I concluded at the end, we ought to be careful and not be too mean to this guy because, you know, what's a cornered rat to do? A cornered rat only has one choice, and that's lash out. And there's one thing that Bush is certainly, it's a rat. And he is more and more cornered, so.
And so is his Olmert pal Olmert. Same thing.
Yeah. Now, okay, so let's say in the hypothetical that, well, I keep losing my connection to Chaos Radio here. What the hell is going on? I have to edit that part out. We'll just keep going here.
Okay.
What the hell? Let's go with the hypothetical.
Okay.
And say that Cheney, for example, gets his way and somehow convinces the Israelis to start the war. Or let's take Gareth Porter's scenario and say Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda guys stage an attack against American forces in Iraq and make it look like Iran was behind it.
Because, yeah, that's a good one.
Because that is what al-Qaeda wants more than anything else, is for America to expand this war to Iran next door. So let's take that hypothetical. Osama bin Laden and the boys blow up some American soldiers in Iraq. They give Dick Cheney a plausible story that Iran was behind it, and a war starts. America starts bombing Iran's nuclear facilities. They go by the war plans that State Department intelligence officer Wayne White has seen, a call for 1,500 sorties, clearing paths to the targets all across Iran, taking on their submarine forces, their boat forces, and whatever amount of air force they have that's actually still operational. This is the superpower against a third world tin pot little country. What ability does Iran have to fight back against the United States of America if we do start this war? Let's start with the Strait of Hormuz. I'm looking at a map right now of this elbow in the Persian Gulf where all the oil and military ships have to pass through this little strait to get out to the sea. What ability does Iran have to close the Straits of Hormuz?
Well, I personally think a very limited one. Keep in mind that what you're describing, the 15,000 sorties, is what I call the U.S. kind of warfare, which what the U.S. does best, is very good at. And the Iranians know that they cannot compete on that kind of warfare. I think the U.S. would very, very rapidly destroy their submarine force, very rapidly destroy their air force. I think the U.S. Navy and Air Force could do a very good job beating Iran on that kind of in that kind of warfare. And that's why I don't think that Iran will actually very meaningfully try to engage in it. Unless, you know, the U.S. makes huge mistakes, I think the Iranians are going to basically retaliate in very different kind of responses and not, you know, try to match a superpower in the superpower kind of war. Just in the same way as Hezbollah last summer did not try to match Israel by launching a conventional offensive into northern Israel. They used Katyusha rockets to, you know, make them paralyze them economically, at least the upper third of the country. And they used well-prepared positions to defend themselves in small groups against the Israeli army. Same thing here.
Mm-hmm. So
I don't think they can close the Strait of Hormuz, and I'm not even convinced that would be a smart strategy because it would alienate the entire planet against them.
Mm-hmm.
As for the U.S. aircraft carriers and the warships, they wouldn't be anywhere near the Strait of Hormuz. They don't need to get that close to actually hit them with their air squadron. So
some of these scare stories that Iran has all these basically PT boat type, military speed boats that they can use swarming tactics. They
have them and they can use them, but that would be more usable in case of a local war. Now, Iraq is out of the picture, but say Saudi Arabia or something local in the region, that's a local power projection tactic.
And what about their supersonic missiles?
Supersonic missiles, first of all, I'm not exactly sure how many of they have, but they need targeting. They need to find something to hit.
That means you need somebody close by with a laser pointing at your target or what?
No, you need radar, you need satellites. It depends on the missile. You need to enter GPS coordinates. There's a number of ways that a missile can be targeted to an objective. And you can count on the U.S. Navy, really suppressing their intelligence capabilities from day one.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to cover them with electronic countermeasures. They're going to hit the radar stations. Very soon, the Iranians are not going to be aware very much of what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz or in the waters around in the Persian Gulf.
All right. Well, let me... Well, I forgot. I had so many different tangents going on there. I forgot which one I wanted to go down. It was something about them fighting back at sea here. Oh, I know what it was. Andrew Coburn's book, Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy.
Yeah, I'm reading it right now.
Oh, are you? It's great, isn't it?
I just began.
He tells the story in there of war games that took place, the blue team versus the red team, before the invasion of Iraq. And this one general, who apparently is an expert at this, always plays the bad guy. He always plays whoever America's enemy is in the war game, and he's really good at it. And that's why that's his job. And he was in the position of being the fictional Saddam Hussein being invaded by the United States. He was the blue team. Or maybe he was the red team, I forget. Anyway, he destroyed the U.S. Navy immediately. And his tactic was... knowing that American ships do have pretty good anti-missile defenses, that rather than shooting them one at a time and hoping to get a lucky hit, he would fire off all of his supersonic anti-ship missiles at once and hope that one or two got through. Well, it worked. And in the war game, he ended up sinking the U.S. Navy, and they hit the restart button like it was Street Fighter II.
Yeah, I haven't read the book yet, but I've heard about that excerpt. But you mentioned it a couple of times on your show. In a distant past, I used to be in a red team kind of exercise in the military.
Uh-huh.
First of all, it depends a lot on the scenario and what you're told you're supposed to practice. Secondly, keep in mind that if the blue team, if the U.S. Navy was told to be sitting inside the Persian Gulf or in the Strait of Hormuz, that's different. I just don't see why they would do that, why they would choose to get that close.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And thirdly, the U.S. Navy has been for decades during the Cold War practicing offensive operations along the Soviet coast, particularly along the Kola Peninsula and the North Atlantic. That's a way more dangerous environment. I mean, that's an environment where I think the U.S. actually would have lost at least a couple of carriers if they had to actually, in case of a real war. I don't think it would have worked, but at least the official posture of the Navy was we're going to, put our aircraft carriers in the North Atlantic and then bomb the Soviets from there. And they practiced that for years. I just don't see the Iranians having the capabilities of penetrating through the defenses that the U.S. Navy would put around the aircraft carrier and their battle groups. But maybe I'm wrong, but I just don't see it happening.
All right, well, that's good news at least. I mean, the thought of American Star Destroyers getting sunk in the Persian Gulf just seems like, if there's one thing Iran could do to get themselves nuked, it would be fighting back effectively and making a fool out of George Bush and Dick Cheney.
Well, I'm not excluding an attack like on the Stark or what the Argentinians did during the Falkland War. There's always a risk of that happening. I don't think they're going to get close to an aircraft carrier. But if somebody sends a destroyer closer to the that's possible. They might hit a U.S. Navy ship. I just don't see them tipping the balance meaningfully and preventing the Navy of conducting its operations or hitting an aircraft carrier.
All right, well, let's talk about William Lynn's article in the American Conservative. I guess I'm willing to bet you've seen it. How to Lose an Army, Surge into Iraq, and then Dig in, and then Bomb
Yeah.
Iran.
Yeah.
And, of course, his point there, and I discussed this on the on this very radio show with William S. Lynn, what he's talking about is the fact that the American supply lines run from Kuwait to Baghdad.
Yes.
And that our forces are what he calls penny packeted all around Baghdad. There is no field army in Iraq anywhere.
Correct.
And if America bombs Iran, that the Shiites that we've put in power and who, for the most part, have not been part of the insurgency, for the most part, who have been biding their time waiting for us to leave because they know that they'll be the ones with the power when we go, they could, and in fact, it would be apparently, it seems to me, quite likely that the Shia Arabs in Iraq would rise up against the Americans who've been training and supplying and paying their way all this time, and that our guys could all get, you know, shot in the back like Order 66. And so I guess one more thing on that point is that last time I talked with Phil Giraldi, he said that the nuclear option for Iran was on the table in two ways. One, to, for example, hit the Natanz facility, which is under 85 feet of granite. And two, to tell the Iranians, you better sit there and take it or we'll nuke Tehran. You are forbidden from fighting back against us once we've started this war. Don't you go after our army in Iraq or we'll nuke you. And so I just wonder, you know, obviously you have very well-informed opinions, original ones, about this situation. So I just want to hear what you think is the danger to American soldiers in Iraq were Cheney to start bombing Iran.
I think the danger is very, very real. And keep in mind, the cute thing is that the Iranians themselves wouldn't even have to do anything. The Badr Brigades and the Mehdi Army and the rest of them would, you know, start attacking. I believe Mokhtar al-Sadr actually made the statement that in case of attack, he would.
And so did Abdulaziz Akim, the head of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which owns the Badr Corps.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that, but it doesn't surprise me. He's really an extension of the Pazdaran, so, I mean, they're essentially like
he's
Iran's
really,
president.
He's really the extension of what?
Of the Iranian Revolutionary
right.
Guards. But right. Even Mokhtar al-Sadr. And, yeah, the supply routes are in danger. There's only two highways that go from Saudi Arabia, which are not capable of sustaining real resupply. So that would be a real risk. And you know what's really scary? In 1991, when the U.S. dropped the 82nd Airborne into Saudi Arabia as part of Desert, what was it, Shield at that time, they had absolutely nothing to back them up. If at that time Saddam Hussein would have decided to cross the Iraqi-Saudi border with his armored corps, the 82nd wouldn't really have stand no chance. They're way too light in their equipment and capabilities. The only thing that they did is tell Saddam Hussein, if you do that, we're going nuclear. And I think there's a real risk of that happening. If the U.S. forces in Iraq got really bogged down, and if, for instance, another possibility, if the Iranians did start something in the southern, in the Basra region, or if the U.S. got in really big trouble, I think there's a real risk that the U.S. would say, you know, we're going to start using tactical nukes on Iran. Yeah.
Which, really, there's a whole segment of the American military and the military-industrial complex that wants an excuse to use a nuke again, don't they? They want to end that nuclear taboo and make it okay to use nuclear weapons in a preemptive war.
Well, they would package that as being defending, you know, our boys, et cetera. And, I mean, that would be clearly indicating. They would raise the threat that, you know, they got intelligence that, well, how did Blair say that? The Iranians are about to nuke them in 45 minutes, as you said, but not something of that kind would, you know, be packaged
yeah.
around it. But, yeah, I think I do not see enough forces in Iraq, U.S. forces, at all to sustain. The surge was, I suspect, partially aimed at protecting the Green Zone, the airport, and the Baghdad region in case of a war with Iran. But how long could they sustain that? And keep in mind that with any scenario involving a war against the U.S. and Iran, time is always on the Iranian side. They can sustain it for years. They've proven it. How long could the U.S. sustain a military effort against Iran? I mean, think about it.
Right. Yeah, it's a real good question.
No rotations anymore. You know, you would have to reinforce the troops, get them there. God knows how. There are a couple of airports that they could use in Iraq, but most of them would have to go through Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. That would be extremely dangerous. You have to protect these lines of resupply. The oil prices would shoot up. Tensions would go up. I mean, can the U.S. sustain that kind of effort for a year, 2 years?
Well, I think this is kind of the premise of this whole idea of bombing Iran is that, well, we'll bomb them for a week till we're done, and then the war will be over.
Yeah.
But that's not the way things work once you start a war.
Well, depending on your objective, I really think that the neocons, their real end goal is to do to Iran what they did to Iraq, which is to, you know, bomb it into the Stone Ages. As Baker said to Tariq Aziz, and if your intention is to destroy the economy and the civilian infrastructure of a country who dares to take a stand against Israel, well, that's doable in 2 weeks, 3 weeks maybe. That's definitely doable.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about the ability of American air power to reduce a place to rubble.
Yep. But will that, you know, what will happen next? I don't think the neocons ever think in these terms what will happen next. What the heck was Yehud Barak thinking about when he invaded Lebanon last time?
Right.
He was seriously saying that he would get back his soldiers, that he would disarm Hezbollah. I mean, please. It was laughable. And, you know, he still went ahead and did it.
You know, Gareth Porter says that one consequence, was it Gareth Porter? Maybe it wasn't Gareth Porter. I'm sorry. I don't want to assign that to him if I'm not positive. But it was one of these people I talked to on this radio show pretty regularly who said, listen, America bombs Iran. What might they do to our puppet dictatorship in, say, for example, Pakistan? Does anybody doubt that Iran's intelligence services are more thoroughly in touch with what's going on in Pakistani society and have their agents in deeper cover? We see all these attempts on Musharraf's life. Could not the Iranians make one of those attempts successful?
Yeah, I mentioned that in my article as a possibility. I think they definitely could. I'm not sure, though, that they would, because remember that the Wahhabis consider the Shias as rejectionist, as worse than impious, you know, idolaters. And they don't want to have a, you know, a Zarqawi type in power in Pakistan, which would probably will replace Musharraf. And also Pakistan has made a statement about a month ago or so that, you know, in case of Iran, of a war between the U.S. and Iran, the Pakistan would be supporting its brotherly Muslim country. So Musharraf is actually not too bad a ruler in Pakistan from the Iranian point of view. They could do it if they get desperate, if they want to trigger a crisis. But I'm not sure it's to their advantage to, you know, to put a Taliban-like character in power in Islamabad.
Hey, tell me, what does it mean when Zbigniew Brzezinski, who has been a very favorite servant of the American establishment for decades now in this country, I think of him as simply the Democratic Henry Kissinger. What does it mean when he's going before the U.S. Senate and saying, listen, guys, You have got to do everything in your power to make sure that there is not a war with Iran. If there is one, we're going to own all the real estate between Israel and India, which to me seems to imply that he believes Jordan and Pakistan will fall, and that we cannot own all this real estate. We cannot control it. It's going to destroy our empire that Zbigniew Brzezinski has worked so hard to build. What does that tell you when somebody who seemingly represents the point of view of the American establishment, like Zbigniew Brzezinski, is publicly begging on TV?
Well, I can't guess what he's thinking, but my guess is that there's, you know, three major lobbies in the U.S. It's the oil lobby, the military-industrial complex, and the neocons. And I think in the case of a war with Iran, only the neocons want it. The other two don't even want part of that.
Not even Lockheed, you think, huh?
You know, the economic consequences might be devastating, so I'm unsure about. I mean, I'm not sure that they have a, you know, coordinated policy, but my guess would be that this is just about too much.
Yeah.
Certainly, the military. I suspect most people don't want that. The U.S. has not been able to protect the Green Zone in Baghdad. They got hit last night again, with two dozen mortars were landed inside the Green Zone. There's no way they can control the real estate between, you know, the Mediterranean and whatever he said, Pakistan. So it just tells me that the only people who are pushing for a war against Iran, absolutely alone, are the neocons. And I am not as sure as you. I heard you on the radio today saying, you know, that they have Israel interest over the U.S. I was listening the other day to Norman Finkelstein, and I think he makes a really good case that the neocons really don't care about Israel either. that what they really care is power, and they have in Israel a good tool to use. They can frighten the people there, and they can frighten American Jews by conjuring images, you know, hammers and sickles and swastikas and Holocaust, etc. But I don't think at all that the neocons really care for Israel.
Well, if they do, they've only proven how absolutely incompetent they are, because this whole clean break strategy has been an absolute disaster for Israel. I mean, anybody who's reasonable at all and thinks that the Israeli state ought to continue to exist for, you know, decades or centuries into the future has got to realize that the only way that that is possible is if they are friends with their neighbors.
Yeah, and if you take a country like Iran, who admittedly is, you know, anti-Israeli for sure, I don't think they're anti-Jewish at all, actually, but they're certainly opposed to an ethnically or religiously Jewish state there. What have the neocons done? They've removed the two biggest enemies of Iran, which is Saddam and the Taliban, and they bogged down the U.S. in Iraq. I mean, you could almost say that, you know, Bush and the neocons did Iran's bidding, which is not quite as impossible as it sounds, considering that Chalabi, who pulled the U.S. into this war, seems to be an Iranian agent.
Well, and you know, there are CIA and DIA guys who say that he was an Iranian agent, and although they certainly knew that all his weapons of mass destruction information was lies, as Paul Wolfowitz says, we settled on that for bureaucratic reasons, I think he really did fool them when it came to what it was going to be like afterwards. There's some great articles that refer to... In fact, I believe it's Bob Dreyfus in Tinker, Banker, Neocon, Spy for the American Prospect, who talks about how this guy had promised them a pipeline to Haifa, oil and water, and a Hashemite king like they have in Jordan, and that the new wonderful westernized, modernized Iraq is going to be a great ally.
Yeah,
of the Israelis. And I don't know. What do you think? You think they bought that, or they just thought, I mean, because I don't know. When you say, look, the neocons have only succeeded in getting rid of Iran's two biggest enemies, it makes me think that they knew they were doing that, but it's simply part of the plan. Act three is Iran. And so that would make it okay if we have a regime change in Iran that we've gotten rid of their enemies because now they're our friends.
You know, possibly. I mean, I can't fathom what must be happening in their brains.
We know what's happening in their brains. You know, Michael Ledeen writes it every week. Faster, please. Turn the whole region into a boiling cauldron and stop dilly-dallying.
Yeah, I mean, look, already in a previous discussion with you, I already said, I really think these guys are not as smart as people think they are. They always think short-term. And they have this imperial hubris of, we can actually boss the entire planet, and sure, we can take care of a bunch of ragheads. So that's how they think about it. But since they began that brilliant plan, they had, you know, the war in southern Lebanon, the war in Iraq, the mess in Afghanistan, where they basically control Kabul at best. But I think they're going to run forward, as the French say. You know, they're going to continue that. I'm still very, very concerned that even if Bush gets replaced, considering who is, you know, likely to replace him, which is at least as neocon as Bush, which is Hillary or Barack Obama, I think the war with Iran is on the agenda until the neocons get thrown out of power in this country. And that, short of a meaningful, real peace movement, you know, back to the Constitution by Ron Paul, Gravel, or Kucinich United or something like this, is inevitable.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Let's make a horrible assumption, although a likely one, that Ron Paul does not get the Democrat or the Republican nomination. That it goes to some fascist warmonger like Benito Giuliani.
Yeah.
You floated this idea on the Stress blog the other day. And you know me, this is what I'm all about. This is kind of what I've had in mind since I first got on the radio here in Austin on free radio back in 1999. I want a realignment. I want the good leftists and the good conservatives and the libertarians to come together around somebody like Ron. Well, this is the way they taught me it happened in the 30s. Every different faction in the 30s joined the New Deal fascist consensus. The Southern, Klansmen types bought into it. The Northern labor types bought into it. The agrarian folks bought into it. The blacks bought into it. Every possible economic and social group basically bought into the FDR scam, except the classical liberals who opposed him. But everybody else kind of came in that grand consensus. Well, that's kind of what I want to see. I want to see a whole new political realignment in this country where people who put the Bill of Rights first come together and ignore the rest of their differences and find a way to move on from here in a way that we're not just choosing between two different employers of the American Enterprise Institute crowd. And you floated the idea on thestressblog.com about Ron Paul joining forces with Mike Gravel, maybe naming Kucinich the Secretary of State in waiting or something like that, and mounting an independent campaign for the presidency next year. Tell us about your idea along those lines, I guess.
Well, essentially, it's because I see that as the only hope that I can think of right now. I mean, I completely agree with you, first of all. All the rest of them are complete IPAC puppets, neocons. I mean, they're hopeless. They're fascist. And what is at stake here? I mean, what's at stake is, you know, having an American republic or a fascist empire waging more and more war. And essentially, as Chalmers Johnson said, there's a choice between empire or republic. And surely, if these people are honest, and I want to assume that they are, Gravel, Kucinich, and Ron Paul realize that this is way beyond them, way beyond politics, and way beyond, you know, their stance on abortion or gun control or anything else. This is crucial. This is, you know, being a republic and standing, you know, returning the U.S. to what it used to be, however imperfect, but it was a republic, or not. And I think they need to formally ally themselves into one group in order to convince their respective constituencies that it doesn't make sense to continue accepting that artificial divide of conservative versus liberals when the political leadership of both conservatives and liberals are in reality fascist.
Right.
It makes no sense to say I'm a liberal, you're a conservative, or something like this, when in reality this is going to end up putting a fascist in the White House.
All right, so how about this? How about, obviously, we'd all like to see Ron Paul go ahead and get the nomination and kick Hillary Clinton's Nazi ass in November of 2008. But let's assume that he doesn't get the nomination. I guess I'm kind of excited by the idea of him continuing to run. And, of course, because of the corruption of Lyndon Johnson here in Texas, he can continue to run as a Republican for his House seat, as he does any of the rest of this stuff, too. He could run. He could mount a third-party campaign. Obviously, all he has to do is ask for the Libertarians and the Constitution Party to give him their nominations, and of course, they'd nominate him in a moment.
The Greens.
And then there's what's left of the Reform Party, and there's the Green Party. If it was really a not a moderate centrist ticket, but a principled Libertarian-style ticket with Paul and his good friend Dennis Kucinich, for example, running in the vice presidential slot. You know, I guess I still don't think they could really win without Lockheed money, but that could really be the start of a new realignment.
Well, you mentioned in one of your shows, you spoke about the educational phase, that what Ron Paul does right now is educating the people. They could do that further into the election by making, you know, a block and educating and just raising the issue of what's at stake, and they could do that together. And if they're not petty politicians, and I don't think they are, at least for sure not Gravel and Ron Paul, who both could have done exactly nothing, and I think they entered this race out of a sense of serving their country. In that case, you know, if they're patriots and if they want to protect and, you know, save their country from the upcoming disaster, they can start by simply making something unique in U.S. history. Former Democrat slash former liberal getting together with former Republican slash conservative like Ron Paul into, say, a Jeffersonian party.
Yeah.
By pulling in somebody like Kucinich or Nader or whoever else, Buchanan, doesn't matter. I mean, the internal politics truly don't matter. But say we stand for, you know, the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah.
I think it would put the neocons in a horrible situation of having somebody screaming, you know, what is it this in English? The king is naked or the emperor is naked, by denouncing them for what they are. And that they could do, and that would be a service to their country. Whether they would get elected or not really doesn't matter at that point.
Yeah, I think even if it wasn't, I mean, because, you know, the amount of money it takes to really make a third party that could compete with the Republicans and the Democrats on their level, that's one thing. But they could even just run a Jeffersonian ticket. And it's funny, you know, the way you talk about You mentioned Nader and Buchanan. Buchanan, of course, ran a unity ticket with Izola Foster, who was, I'm not exactly sure which brand of left-wing radical, but they agreed about enough, and they ran together. There's Pat Buchanan, that Nazi racist for you, running with a black woman as his on his ticket for president. But go ahead and bring in Buchanan and Nader and Izola Foster and Mike Gravel and Dennis Kucinich and Walter Freedom Fries Jones and the anti-war Republicans, the very few of them in the Congress. Bring in the very best of the anti-empire left. And, well, like you said in your blog post, go ahead and name Kucinich as Secretary of State, or go ahead and name, what positions these people would likely take. And, I don't know. TV keeps saying, Ron Paul, he's a fringe candidate and he can't possibly win and it doesn't really amount to anything and this and that. But, I take one look at Ron Paul and then I look at George W. Bush and I think, now, how could anyone in this country look at Ron Paul and think that he's, somehow too fringy or whatever, not qualified enough to be the president of the United States? When they look at George W. Bush, who Ron Paul is, 100,000, 200,000 times the man George W. Bush is, it should be very easy, I think, for people to look at Ron Paul, especially after George Bush has lowered the bar so low.
Yeah.
And Ron Paul ought to be able to go in there and go, look, people, do you seriously think I'd be a worse president than what we got now? I mean, come on.
Keep in mind, you're speaking about, the money for a third party, but we're talking about a second party. And they could and should sell themselves as a second party. They could call themselves the other party or the Jeffersonian, as I said, or whatever.
Yeah, we'll start
and
calling the other guys
money.
The Democratic Republicans like the Jeffersonians used to be called.
It wouldn't take that much money because there is the facade of pluralism and democracy still in this country. I mean, they can't openly, Soviet style, only report of the latest party meeting. So if the opposition is identified as being this other party, they would have to cover it, even if it's to slander and bash it. That's fine. It would take care of, and secondly, to have these people together on one ticket would be such a media event that I think they would get a lot of coverage for free. They wouldn't need that much money.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, man, this is the most optimistic I've been in a long time, Vineyard Saker. I've been paying attention to politics and particularly to Ron Paul, for more than a good decade now.
Do you think they're talking to each other quietly, Kucinich, Gravel, Paul?
I don't know about Gravel. I know for a fact that Paul and Kucinich are friends and work together on things all the time, and Paul loves to take any opportunity he can to say nice things about Dennis Kucinich and how he considers him a personal friend and how they get along well and how, and in fact he cites his friendship with Kucinich when people ask him if he can work well with people across the aisle because he says, Dennis and I are great friends and we can argue about economics and, and it's just fine.
I hope if they did that, they would clearly say that, we're not going to give you a 100-point party political platform because you don't have it. And that's going to be for the regular parties that we have to be decided in a congressional election. But for the executive power, what our program is peace and restoration of civil rights. I mean, that's all it takes.
Yeah.
Well, and if you have any contacts with, Ron Paul's campaign or anybody else, try to suggest to them that, that's fine on phase one to try to get the nomination first. But if that doesn't work, they should have plan B already ready.
Well, I'm sure that they've thought about things like this. I have to tell you, Ron is on the record as saying, and I take the man's word for it when he says things. I don't think that he's a liar in any sense. And he said that he's not really considering that his plan would be in the default, I guess, if he doesn't get the nomination to run for his House seat again and continue on from there. Obviously that could change.
Oh, hopefully.
And particularly, I just love the idea of the Libertarians, the Reform Party, the Constitution Party, and the Green Party all nominating the Paul Gravel or Paul Kucinich ticket. And actually, I should tell you, too, I would like the Paul Kucinich ticket much more. I think Gravel is a decent guy, but I think his image as a nut is, it's like he's trying to play off of that and thinks it's working well for him. And I don't think he's deep enough. There's plenty of things I disagree with Kucinich about, but you know, the most thing they can say about him is, you know, really is that he looks like an elf, but he doesn't, you know, he doesn't engage in some of the antics of Mike Gravel, who seems to already have accepted that he's last place boy, and hopefully at least he'll make some ripples in the pond or something like that, and that's not good enough.
And keep in mind, the other funny thing is that the other side then would start protecting, you know, backing each other. I mean, can you imagine Giuliani calling for the election of Hillary in response?
Oh,
it would
absolutely.
Be hilarious.
Absolutely. I mean, they're all pieces of the same pod. There's no doubt about it. And you know what? We got so far off on this direction.
Okay.
Let me go back to the Iran thing real quick, because
sure.
I want to ask you, can you tell me which country you were in the military there in, for how many years, or which years you were in, or when you got out, something like that?
Well, I was somewhere in Europe, and I was there for, let's say, a while.
Uh-huh.
I want to keep it at that.
And it ended this century or last century? Or
it ended last, well, at the beginning of the century.
The beginning of the century, okay. Well, my question's about Al-Qaeda.
Okay.
My question's about Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri and the movement that they've spawned. Is it in fact the case that Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri and friends consider Iran to be near the top of their list of enemies, right up there with the United States and the Kingdom and Saudi Arabia?
Oh, yeah. First of all, I'm not convinced that there really is such thing as Al-Qaeda in terms of a unified, organized, streamlined, you know, controlled organization, or there ever was. But there certainly is a philosophical movement, and that goes way even before them. I mean, from the very beginning, from the history of Wahhab himself in Saudi Arabia, they consider them worse than pagans. They're rejectionist. When the Wahhabis got their hands on Shia Mosque in southern, what is today southern Iraq, they burned them to the ground and massacred them. They truly hate the Shia. Not all Sunnis, but that specific Wahhabi trend, most definitely.
Mm-hmm. And so they would really consider all this threat of the neocons somehow tricking the American people into thinking that Iran is the threat, that they back terrorism, which you just fill in the blank there with that vagary and imagine those towers coming down again. If we do this, this is exactly what bin Laden wants?
Yes. I mean, bin Laden and his supporters, I'm not sure he matters very much, but that Wahhabi Salafist movement would love to see American bombs hitting Shia mosques in rejectionist Iran. Absolutely.
Okay, now be more specific, though, because you seem to just be saying, I know a thing or two about Wahhabism, and believe me, they don't like the Shia. But is there any actual evidence that Al-Qaeda has it out for the mullahs?
Oh, of course. First of all, the few Al-Qaeda members that are in Iran are sitting in their jails. Iran almost went to war against Afghanistan when the Taliban's took over one of their embassies in western Afghanistan and killed all the diplomats. The Iranians massed their army at the border, and then the U.S. said, oh, no, 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 no. That's not the kind of stuff you can solve by force. You have to do it by negotiation, et cetera. They immediately sided with the Taliban at that time. There is a history of Saudi Arabia itself and Wahhab and how they treated the Shia. There is the hatred that Al-Qaeda likes in Iraq show for Muqtada al-Sadr and the Shia there. I mean, it's all over the place. Certainly, there's a consistent record of, again, I don't say all Sunni, but of Wahhabis always going after the Shia as being the impious rejectionist.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to pull up your website here real quick because you just... You just wrote something along these lines. I wish whenever you do these things, man, just double post them all on stress. Would you?
I don't want to take too much of your space out. And yeah, I had an article. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Al-Qaeda threatens to wage war in Iraq.
Yeah, I'm looking for the quote here. I'm paging down on the page because this is the quote, assuming that this translation is correct. This quote from Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, who leads the group Islamic State in Iraq, said his Sunni insurgents, see, this isn't even necessarily just Al-Qaeda in Iraq, this just sounds like the Sunni insurgent types, have been preparing for 4 years to wage a battle against Iran. The AP reported, quote, "We are giving the Persians, and especially the rulers of Iran, a two-month period to end all kinds of support for the Iraqi Shiite government and to stop direct and indirect intervention. Otherwise, a severe war is waiting for you," he said in the 50-minute audio tape. So there's a couple of things here. First of all, who supports the Iraqi government besides America?
Iran.
Iran. That is, America is backing the Iranian factions in Iraq. And now here's Al-Qaeda telling the Iranians, if you don't stop backing the Badr Corps that's killing our guys, we're coming to Tehran. We're coming after you sons of bitches.
That's exactly it.
We'll give you 2 months. And I like the way you... I guess you did mention this on my blog and in the comment section at least, and said, well, you know, I wonder how long before these guys, Al-Qaeda, are invited into NATO or what.
CENTCOM, yeah, I wrote that.
Yeah, into CENTCOM.
Oh, the joke.
Into the coalition of the willing. And, you know, pardon me if I'm just jaded and cynical at this point, but is it the case that in 2007 the United States of America is backing Al-Qaeda in Lebanon and at least, you know, directly and at least de facto backing them against Iran at this point?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I mean, that's certain. Not only in Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon, but also inside Iran, they're supporting Al-Qaeda likes.
Jundullah?
Pardon me?
Jundullah? Is that the group you're thinking of?
I don't remember what I know some abbreviation for that group, but that's the group that was involved with CIA recently. I don't have it right at the top of my mind right now what it's called. But yeah, of course, that's what did Seymour Hersh call that? The realignment?
The redirection.
The redirection.
Well, now
sure.
And look,
they're backing the Saudis. As long as the United States stands behind this House of Saud, that's already backing Al-Qaeda.
Well, indirectly, yeah.
Well, pretty darn directly, that's where the money goes.
Of course, well, but it's not just, you know, American aid to Saudi Arabia. It's our petrodollars.
Yeah, but, I mean, a lot of that is U.S. and it's America's protection for that regime. You think
right.
The House of Saud would remain in power without U.S. protection? I don't.
No, I do not.
So there's a lot of signs that has been happening. You know, it's what is it that they're saying? It's a son of a bitch, but it's my son of a bitch?
Yeah.
That's exactly the kind of logic that's behind the current support. And I wouldn't put it past that this administration to start putting Baathist right back in power and replace Maliki when it's when he's too lost already. The Shia withdrawing support for him. I mean, yeah, they're capable of doing that.
Yeah.
Supporting Al-Qaeda.
Well, yeah, I want to answer to this besides, well, it's a mystery or neocons are dumb or something. How is it? Why is it? What is the strategy that has America going with the Sunni tilt from Lebanon to Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states and everything else, and yet still we're supporting the Iran factions in Iraq? I mean, what, a year and a half, 2 years ago? Was it 2 years ago? Yeah. 2.5, 3 years, I forget. I'm sure you remember, I guess it was 2005, Khalil Zad, who was at that time the ambassador to Iraq, was basically proposing the Sunni pivot or something. Let's abandon the elected Shiite government and let's back the Sunnis. Let's back the Baathists. There was a whole thing in Time magazine about where they quoted Baathists as saying, yeah, we can't figure out why we didn't get along. We used to be such good friends in the 1980s. And at least that would be consistent, it seems to me, if we were to stab the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in the back and try to reinstall the Sunni Arabs in power. How is it that America is still backing Iran in Iraq while they're backing the Sunnis and fighting against Iran everywhere else?
Well, there are probably a mixture of three reasons. First of all, you have to keep up a facade of democracy somehow. And the majority of the people in Iraq are Shia. So it's kind of hard to openly back a Sunni dictatorship again. At least in Saudi Arabia, most people are not Shia but Sunni. Secondly, there's the real risk of having Ayatollah Sistani and the rest of the Shia just starting war. In that kind of a scenario. And that's something the U.S. really cannot afford.
Right.
And thirdly, the neocons had that myth of being greeted with flowers the same way as the Israelis had very originally in southern Lebanon when they rejected the Palestinians from there. The neocons kept that image of the Shia basically being in agreement, at least initially, with their invasion. And the Shia were at least neutral when the U.S. invaded Iraq, so that it worked for a little while. But now the real risk is if you start putting in power a former Baathist and openly switching allegiance, the risk is an insurrection by the Shia, who are the majority.
Yeah. Well, so I guess we all ought to just take heart that Joe Lieberman continues to write in the Wall Street Journal and pronounce as loud as he can on TV that Iran has already declared war against us. How long are we going to sit back and let them do this? And this, you just fill in the gaps with whatever nightmares you can imagine, I guess.
Yeah, but at least give him credit. He's honest about that. I mean, at least he's, you know, coming out and honestly showing his allegiance, his agenda. I mean, at least I'm thankful that he does that.
Yeah, thanks to Lieberman for being an honest liar.
Yeah.
We appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen,
exactly,
I'm Joe Lieberman, and everything I'm about to say is a damned lie. Listen up.
Yeah, and Giuliani, them together.
Yeah, those two. Oh, man. All right, well, is there anything I left out about America's relationship with Iran here that people ought to know about, Vineyard Saker?
No, I think we covered it all. And you mentioned a couple of days ago the huge pro-American demonstration on 9/11.
Yeah.
That took place in Tehran. I wish people remembered that the Iranian people are not at all what they're described here as being, you know, raving anti-Americans who just want to kill them all. It's not true at all.
Have you been to Iran?
No, never.
But
if I had, I wouldn't be able to live here, I think.
So, yeah, well, yeah, if that was on your visa.
But I had contacts with Iran, let's put it this way.
Yeah, you know, this is something I always get a kick out of, really, is seeing footage of other people's countries and thinking to myself, hey, wow, they all look like Americans. You show me a picture of, you know, people in the park in Tehran, and it looks like it could be any town in the Rocky Mountains somewhere.
Well, some of them. Others wouldn't behave the way Americans behave in American parks, put it this way. But essentially, yeah, we're all humans. It sounds quaint, but it's so true.
Yep. All right. Well, I appreciate your insight. Everybody, read what Vineyard Saker writes at vineyardsaker.blogspot.com. And he also writes at my blog, thestressblog.com. And I'd give you his bio like I do the rest of these interviews, except I don't know. It's a big secret. Hey, man, thanks a lot for coming
on
the show.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for everything you're doing.
All right, cool, man. Talk
Bye-bye.
To you soon. All right, folks, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I don't know why, but apparently I'm losing my connection to the Anti-War Radio server over and over again here. So there's only a few of you even listening at this point, but looks like maybe things are starting to work right again. I don't know. I think Miss Shauna was trying to call in and tell me what the problem was, but I didn't answer because I was just starting a conversation with Vineyard Saker, and then I didn't realize for half an hour that something weird was going on with the server. So anybody who wants to hear the interview that they only heard little bits and pieces of just now, all you have to do is look at thestressblog.com or scotthortonshow.com a little bit later on to find the MP3 of that. And, you know, I really wanted to try to get Gene Healy on the show today, but I think there might be either he's just busy or there's a Cato rule against doing anything that has anything to do with antiwar.com, because we put the Cato Institute to shame for their statism just by comparison. Not that, you know, we spend our days attacking them. We just make it obvious. Anyway, so I guess I'll try to play for you some more of this, some of this Beastie Boys, and take a little break here and come back and discuss some more news or something. Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I bet it's gonna get really funky right here in a second, y'all. Or something. Maybe. I hope.
cut off the symbol.
Alright guys, I'm sorry man, the server is obviously trashed. I don't know if it's on my end or Chaos's end or where the problem is, but as you all know, you've been getting kicked off and I've been getting kicked off and this whole goddamn show's been a disaster. So I'm gonna go ahead and turn it over to Sean Kay and hope everything's better tomorrow, 11 to 1 Texas time. Anti-War Radio. Here comes some Shauna with some music. What do you guys think of this new Beastie Boys? Not too bad, huh? I don't know, I kind of wish they were rapping, you know?